Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 559th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and the director of practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also an adjunct professor at the University of Alberta.
And ketamine, part two.
Ketamine, part two. So where did we leave off in part one? Well, we talked about the background of ketamine, some of the kind of how do we think it might be working? Mm-hmm. What are some of the limits of the evidence? What is the media saying about it? And then we got into, we had a long conversation kind of about a lot of those features. And then we talked about summarizing the evidence, the best available evidence about how effective it might be, acknowledging that for ketamine, which seems to have about a 20% improvement over placebo or control, it might be exaggerated. The best available evidence is suggesting it might be that might be double what it really is.
Yeah, yeah.
And then for S-ketamine, it's somewhere around a 10% over 10 to 15% over placebo. These are mostly treatment-resistant depression. And we looked at kind of what kind of numbers might we be looking at for a change in MADRS score, which goes from 0 to 60. Anything kind of in the high 20s is more severe depression. Certainly, it depends on where you look. Some call 20 to 34 moderate, others call kind of 28 severe. So, and these guys, if they start out somewhere around 28, placebo will get them down about 14 and S-ketamine will get you down 18 points. So it works a little bit better.
And I would say these numbers are very similar to what you would see in people who have severe depression. The placebo response is probably about 30%. And then, it goes to maybe 45.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just that they're not getting a big improvement. Often if they're treatment resistant, and depending on the subgroups, like the elderly, mm-hmm. treatment resistance, very hard to see benefits. So there are often 20% in the placebo group and 30% in treatment arm, kind of at best. So where we left off was we were going to talk about kind of some of the nuances of where the evidence is, like how long does it work for, those kind of things. And we're going to talk first about the how long it works for, then we're going to talk about stopping, etc. But let's start with how long. And there's a number of meta-analyses that have looked at this. The first has 48 RCTs combining both ketamine and S-ketamine, and it has 3,300 patients or so. And if you looked at the responder analysis and the standard mean differences, ketamine's best evidence is really around the kind of 1 to 3 days. That's where its evidence shines. And remember, if you recall from the first podcast, a lot to do with biases here because these trials are too short and often 90% of them or so are a single dose. So getting substantive data, many of them only about half go to even 7 days, so or beyond 7 days. So it really is what's going on here is also a limitation of the evidence. And for S-ketamine, we have better evidence that it's going to kind of 28 days. And that's because not that it's more effective per se, but it's being given regularly mm-hmm. and followed for longer. So it's understand that when I'm saying our evidence that it works over a certain time frame, it's really based on the limits in the evidence more than any reading you can get from the effectiveness of the drugs.
Yeah, it just assumes that you continue to take it. So if you were to take it every, you know, if something works for 24 hours, but you take it every day for a month, then you could say it works for a month.
Yeah, you could. Yeah, these ones are tricky. So we'll get in. Mm-hmm. We did get a bit of that data, and that was from just S-ketamine. Mm-hmm. Again, always intranasal when we talk about these because these are the proprietary product. They're the one that's come to market recently. 1,400 patients, 8 RCTs, followed for 1 to 4 weeks. And what they found was the MADRS score was down about 3 points extra over placebo with S-ketamine. So again, that's right on that cusp of what could be clinically meaningful. And at 24 hours, the remission, they didn't give response here, they gave remission. The remission numbers are a number needed to treat of 11. So that's a percent reduction, an improvement of about 9%. At 4 weeks, the same reduction in score of about 3, but remission now number needed to treat is 20. So that's about a 5% reduction instead. So not a big change, and certainly nothing that we would test or know was statistically significant. But it is a signal that maybe it's not working as well. And if it wasn't, there's reasons for that. We know that these are treatment-resistant patients. These are the sickest patients. And if they're going to get a response early, sometimes that can be just kind of a short-term burst out of depression. So I don't think it's saying we should throw the baby out with the bathwater or anything, and it's not working. It's just saying that it might not work as well in the long term. But yeah, we're going to get to that.
And I would say, you know, we are going to talk about the side effects of the medication, because I think that's really important. And to suggest, I mean, it would be great if it could help some people with depression over a 4-week period, but we need treatments that work longer than that.
Yeah, exactly. 4 weeks. And as ridiculous as it sounds, these are generally the longer studies. We're just about to talk about one of the longer ones, but a lot of the research is kind of 4 weeks. But that brings us to this next study, which is, again, you know, we're getting these studies because this is a drug that is funded by the drug company, and therefore research is funded by the drug company because they can make money off it. And so they're doing much bigger and longer studies. So this is an RCT of esketamine again, and it's on top of an antidepressant. And what they looked at is they took a bunch of patients. It was around 450 or so, and they put them on esketamine, added to their antidepressant, and if they responded, they stayed in the trial. So if they had remission or response, they stayed in. So this is, you know, James, you and I have presented on these types of studies, these withdrawal studies. It's important to understand that when you do a withdrawal study, you should be seeing bigger effects than what you would see if you just randomized people out of the hop.
Oh, no, exactly. Because you've already selected the ones that it worked in.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. And I just think it's so important for people to understand that kind of nuance of why we're going to see slightly bigger numbers. But it still speaks to the fact that some people appear to be benefiting from this. So you're going to hear me say there's real questions of whether it works at all later. And these do give more credence to the idea that there's something going on. So esketamine 56 or 84 milligrams intranasal, that every two times a week versus placebo. Already in remission, so already on these drugs, and then they get switched after to withdraw for 18 weeks and see what happens. So this is already a bigger study than we've seen. So you're taking that 297 that felt better and continuing them on therapy or switching them to placebo. After 18 weeks, if you were on esketamine continuing, 26%, so 1 in 4 relapsed. If you were switched to placebo for your spray, 50% of them relapsed. So you can see that the difference there is a number needed to treat very close to 4. If you look at the MADRS.
But what's important is that 50% didn't relapse, period.
Yes. Yeah. Yep.
Even once they took them off it.
Yeah. So, and then if you look at the MADRS score, it was 6 to 7 points better, depending on the end time point, if you stayed on esketamine. So you remember me saying that the general change is around 3 to 4. Now it's 6 to 7. It's that exact same thing. The benefit we were seeing before with esketamine was about a 10% improvement. This time we're seeing about a 20% difference. This is all because it's a withdrawal study. But it does tell us something that we weren't getting from the ketamine research, which is what happens when you stop to someone who's gotten better. So it is very, very helpful piece of research to let us know that if this is working, needs to probably be continued in many patients. Sure, they can try, but if they've, many of these patients are very sick patients who've suffered from depression for a long time. And so I suspect many of them would choose to stay on to avoid relapse, which is around a 50% chance. if they just stop.
Yeah. And interestingly, in this study, this is a stopping study. So any side effects that you might have been getting from the esketamine would likely go away. And that is what they found, right?
Yeah. So it's interesting because in many studies, when we give an intervention or a placebo, we're counting things that occur. So these are things, in a sense, that kind of go away. Mm-hmm. So if you were in the esketamine arm, 25% of them had vertigo versus 6% who switched to placebo. Dizziness was 20% versus 5%. Somnolence was 21 versus 2%. Bad taste, which is a common complaint with this intervention. Don't forget it's a nasal spray too. Mm-hmm. But it can happen with ketamine, is 27% versus 7%. Blurred vision, 16 versus 1%. Nausea, 16 versus 1%. Disassociation, which is one of the targeted effects of this, that one of the mechanisms which we think it might work, is 23% versus 0%. And problems with blood pressure goes up a bit with ketamine briefly, and esketamine, and those peak at 40 minutes. Disassociation and blood pressure increases and then are normal at 1.5 hours.
And I would suggest that the degree of reduction of bad, of adverse events, if you will, or adverse effects, there are very few drugs that cause this many side effects.
Oh yeah, and we'll see when we list them all. This is scratching the
surface. The only other one is cannabis.
Yes, it is. That was another one. Like, yeah. I remember you presenting the data the first time with me, and you kind of saying, would this drug make it to market?
Yeah, it wouldn't in a million years. That's why it didn't have to, because it was already marketed.
That's right. It didn't need to. That's the trick. Would it have made it to market?
Yeah.
No, it didn't need to. It had a different mechanism. So yeah. So let's talk about the next thing that kind of crossed my mind, which we actually have research for, was ketamine versus ECT. And this is not esketamine anymore. This is ketamine. And these are some bigger studies. So interesting and followed for a bit longer.
Yeah. And I think it's important because people are going, if antidepressants don't work, where do we go from there?
Right. And so there's augmentation. We'll talk about two studies. This is the first idea is ECT. And these are for patients. It's been talked about in a whole bunch of ways as kind of being a rescue drug that gets you out of depression quicker. So kind of like ECT. So the first meta-analysis published literally, it's in the summer in June, and then I think I've got this figured out, and it was 2 weeks later the next study was published. But let's dig in. So there's a study of 5 RCTs with 278 patients, and like most of these, they're given as in ketamine, you get 0.5 milligrams per kilogram. It's infused over 40 minutes. You're observed during that time. You have, there's a lot of planning in these. Some have more, psilocybin has the most, but some have more kind of playing relaxing music, having people there with you to kind of counsel you through this session. But they also have people on site if your blood pressure changes too much, if you, there's always risks, there's concerns about QT changes, all sorts of things. So there's always facilities on site for these. Or at least the regulated ones. And then that's versus ECT, and both were given either 2 or 3 times a week for 1 to 4 weeks. And the results were that it generally favored ECT being better, but it was driven by one study of 186 patients, which, as you can tell, makes up the vast majority of the 278 meta-analysis. And these patients, they were European patients, and in this study, the patients were quite a bit sicker than the average patient. All were hospitalized. 40% had needed ECT in the past. Their MADRS score was 34, which is quite severe. And 17% of them had psychotic features to their depression, which is obviously very severe. So it looks like ECT is better, 75% responding versus 59% with ketamine, based on primarily on this study of very sick patients.
Yeah.
Go ahead, James.
No, I was going to say, and clearly this is not a blinded trial.
No.
And you know, the fact that 40% had already had ECT may bias it in favor.
Oh, for sure.
Right?
For sure, because those are the patients who will do better.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. So
the next study is 400 patients, ECT 3 times a week versus ketamine 2x a week, same 0.5 milligrams, kilogram, et cetera, followed for 3 weeks. And this is US patients. 11% were hospitalized, so quite different there. 11% had passed ECT use, a drop. Madras was a tiny bit lower, but patients with psychotic features were actually excluded. So these are, I don't really want to use the word mild, because they're certainly not mild depression. This is quite advanced depression, but they're not as severe as the other group. And in this group, ketamine was slightly better than ECT by about 10 to 15% remission and response rate. So the response rate didn't reach statistical significance, but it was similar type numbers. So 55% getting to remission on a kid's score versus ECT of 41% getting there. So, and the change in Madras was slightly better, 15 points versus 13 for ECT.
Yeah, so I think it's good that you try to do these head-to-head comparisons, but it's because it does sort of, I guess, help you pick the thing that you perceive to be the least evil.
Yeah. And also here, so what you're left with is a bit of guesswork, and this is not uncommon in medicine. But if you are an evidence-based person and you're guessing from interpretation, you would say, I wonder if ECT is the choice for the most severe patients, and ketamine might be reasonable for those not quite so severe, but still severe.
Yeah, I think there'd be a little patient preference too on this one.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. But I it's interesting. I suspect if I had ECT and it worked, that's what I would pick. But
yeah,
also patients would probably not pick ECT just because of the way it's been portrayed in the media.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. And then there's one sort of final look at maybe what would be considered a third line-ish type of thing, and it's versus the augmentation with antipsychotics.
Right, exactly. And so this is they're honest this time. It's an open label study.
Yeah.
They all really are, as you indicate. And almost 700 patients, 676 patients. Again, like, all of these just published this year, often in the summer, trying to scramble to keep up. And it's S-ketamine 28 to 84 milligrams intranasal spray versus quetiapine 150 to 300 milligrams titrated up. And Madras score is 31. And S-ketamine was delivered in clinic, as you would suspect. So that's why it's open label. And if you compare the two, at 8 weeks, it was 27% getting remission in S-ketamine versus 18% in quetiapine. And at 32 weeks, it was 22% versus 14%. So those numbers needed to treat are 11 versus 14. You can see this trial obviously went a lot longer than the four-week
one. And it also tells you that none of these are wonder treatments.
Exactly. I think that's so important based on, and kind of what I was saying earlier, like even in the short term, we're seeing at best 50 to as little as 30%, 30, 35% getting response remission. And in here, we're looking at, and this is a harder target. Remission is harder than response generally. So it's a little bit, expect a little bit lower numbers, but 27 to 14 is these numbers. It's not great at all. Madras score was exactly what you'd expect, about 3 or 2 better. And interestingly, more patients stopped quetiapine than S-ketamine. There's lots of reasons why that could be, because the adverse events were more common in S-ketamine. The only adverse event that was more common with quetiapine was somnolence.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's just really interesting. I think it's, you know, this is all that expectation bias and everything. People are in the new expensive fancy drug. They're going to stick with it.
Yeah. And you're not comparing against it. Quetiapine is not without side effects.
No. It's not it's not a benign drug by any stretch.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's get to something that we talk a lot about here on the podcast that's often ignored, is adverse events. And so there is some data on that, and we discussed it already with the withdrawal trial, but there is a lot of adverse events with these interventions. Let's start with ketamine. So ketamine versus placebo, if you look at agitation or anxiety, it was 34% versus 17%, so a doubling of that. confusion, 52% versus 21. Disassociation was 13 versus 0. And then there was some short-term testing for cognitive scores that they were slightly worse. If you look at versus ketamine versus midazolam, blurred vision occurred 43% versus 8. Dizziness was 27 versus 8. Nausea and vomiting, 22 versus 6. And then increased BP or heart rate was 60% versus 14. So just it's a reminder to us that these are not innocent. Now, profound depression is a very important condition, and obviously we want to treat that, but it's not without adverse effects. And if we jump to esketamine, which had bigger trials and longer trials, we have more data and more adverse events collected. But they did a trick. So we were talking about how, at least with industry, we're getting bigger, longer studies because they're kind of because these have much better funding. But the catch is they do tricky things in there that help the appearance of the product. So one of the ways that you can minimize adverse events is separating the same thing out four or five ways. So you can have sedation or sleepiness.
Yeah,
go ahead, James.
No, you say, or feeling drunk versus postural dizziness. I mean,
yeah, versus dizziness, versus dizziness, versus postural dizziness, versus feeling drunk.
Yeah, versus nausea, vomiting.
Yeah, versus sensory disturbance. And vertigo. And vertigo is listed.
Yeah.
So a lot of these are the same, and it's drawn out like this so that you can. Sometimes I'm not saying that they did it for sure, but sometimes they draw out all these ones so that they can minimize them. You sure you were having more dizziness versus feeling drunk? So
yeah.
We're not going to go through all of them, but let's just jump to some big ones. Disassociation was 28 versus 4%. Dizziness was 30 versus 11. Nausea and vomiting, 36 versus 15. Paresthesia and neuropathy sensations was 14 versus 4. Sensory disturbance, 19 versus 3. So those are just some common ones that I think are worth mentioning. And we've gone through, when we were joking, we've gone through a lot of them already. But there is a lot of short-term side effects.
So making it virtually, I think it really puts it in perspective, because the number of people who get side effects is well above the number of people who get benefit.
Yeah, well, in fact, if we looked at the antipsychotic one, 85% reported an adverse event in esketamine. So if you compare that to how many got better over esketamine, it's something like 8%. So yeah, the numbers are not necessarily in favor. You'd have to, but I think that's why we're choosing very sick people, because they might tolerate these adverse events a little more.
And then I think and we have to always be very careful, because I think the next step is to talk about if we normalize the use of ketamine, we have to remember that this is a drug of abuse.
Yeah. And that's it. So, you know, in RCTs, especially these small ketamine ones, which such short follow-up, et cetera, and even S-ketamine, we don't have, like, certainly 18 weeks, et cetera, 32 weeks, these feel like long, but they're not that long. The new studies that we're looking at for pain management with opioids, for example, are like I think they're giving us a reasonable chance of knowing is a year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so we're not getting those. So what we're left doing is looking back at kind of observational studies around ketamine and in when it's used recreationally. So not necessarily in substance use disorder, but recreationally. And some of it will be substance use disorder. And the terms that are used for it in recreational use are vitamin K, special K, K. It has a bunch of names, and we don't need to go over all of them.
No, but we do know how much you love vitamins.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe that's why I seem to be talking about some of the downsides of ketamine. So this is so in North America, we don't have the use of ketamine as a recreational substance isn't as strong as elsewhere. A couple studies found that anywhere between 0.5% and 2% of teens and college students said they had used ketamine in the past. But in Asia, it's actually the second or third most common substance of abuse. So it's a bit of a surprise to me.
Yeah, that's quite something because I don't know exactly how much cannabis would, but they have. I doubt that they're including alcohol because.
Yeah,
but who knows?
I doubt that because it would obviously be number one on any record.
Yeah, yeah.
There's so many things, opioids and cannabis and so many things that we can misuse and abuse. Yeah. Now there are case reports of, so that background is recreational use. There are case reports of iatrogenic where ketamine or S-ketamine has been prescribed and things have gone poorly from withdrawal to suicide. I found a couple of those.
Yeah.
And the FDA requires a black box warning of abuse or misuse risk with the product. In street use, it's clearly associated with cognitive impacts. Mm-hmm. And we don't have that data as strongly in antidepressants. There is some short-term scoring with cognition with ketamine that was reduced, but not dramatically. And this this is more dramatic with recreational use. The really interesting one for me was the irritation to the bladder that ketamine has. And it bothers the epithelial layer of the bladder and irritates it. And it can lead to interstitial cystitis and then even ulcerative cystitis where you're getting ulcers in the bladder.
There are very few drugs that do that.
Yeah, I know. Like, well, the smoking certainly has direct effects on the bladder as well, causing bladder cancer. But this is, so 30% of recreational users complain of bladder symptoms. So one in three, it's remarkable. And in S-ketamine, where the doses are obviously smaller and more controlled, it's around 2% versus about 0.3% with placebo. So not a big rise there, but it is something that we need to be aware of and attentive to. Lots of talk about transient BP increases, heart rate increases, and QT elongation. In 1,700 patients studied in clinical trials of depression, only one had an increase greater than 500 milliseconds.
It's not
going to be common, but it is something seen in recreational use. For pregnancy, there is, again, some studies in animals. These are always sad to think about, but there is studies in animals where they show that it can be a problem for development of the unborn. And then the in recreational use, there was one case report with trouble resulting from use in pregnancy. So with malformations, that kind of thing. So it's definitely a risk and we need to be attentive to that. We just don't know yet with pregnancy. And it'll be a long time before we ever figure that out.
If ever.
There's lots of talk about not using it with benzos because benzos might reduce the effect of ketamine for depression and lamotrigine the same. These authors from the Expert Opinion Drug Safety Journal did an excellent job and they kind of combed the literature and they found that if you took all of the patients in a series of ketamine studies, there were 7 deaths out of 764 patient years. And 4 were of suicide, where in the placebo arm, and there was a lot less people in it, 175 patient years versus 764, there were 0.
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky. There's no way that would be statistically different, but it's, you know, you're really just looking for any sort of a signal.
That's exactly what I would say, James, that this is a signal. And I don't know that it means, again, well, we stop all of this, but it sure does resonate about, you know, the need for ongoing monitoring with the use of these products.
Oh, yeah, like, yeah. Not by the individual healthcare provider, oversight by people who know what they're doing.
Yeah, and reporting of these adverse events.
Yeah.
Because we would hate to be long down this road to figure out that this was an increased risk that was signaled this early.
Yeah, no, exactly. So then the final thing, and the good thing about these drugs is they're all free.
Yeah, they're so cheap. So let's talk about how much they cost.
They're a little bit away from free.
Yeah, they're a tiny bit more than that. So ketamine's a bit tricky because it's given in hospital. Mm-hmm. So that means there's all of the collection of costs that come with that.
Right.
So you have to have it, and you have to have people around. Some are saying you need at minimum someone who can perform basic resuscitation, all the way up to having anesthesia around. Yeah. I don't think our new guidelines recommend that, but they do support having a lot of kind of support for giving this. For esketamine, it's a little different because there the cost is almost all the drug cost. And when you go in, you can actually go to a clinic as long as you stick around after you use it. So what is the cost of esketamine? As I said, we don't really know ketamine because of the ancillary cost. Ketamine at 28 milligrams, I shouldn't laugh when I read this, of an intranasal dose is, just pausing for effect here, $273.
Yeah. So $10 a milligram.
$10 a milligram. So if you're like many patients who require 2 to 3 sprays twice a week to get you started, and then weekly for weeks 5 to 8, and then every 2 weeks or so from 9 weeks on, the estimated cost from the Canadian Drug Expert Committee is $18,500 to $45,500. And then fortunately the price drops, James, quite dramatically. To $14,000 to $42,000.
Yeah.
So $3,000 off. So
yeah. And what good and for that price, you don't just get a benefit, you get all the harm. So
no, it is remarkable the cost of that product.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Obviously there's a sense that there's a market for it, but
I guess, yeah.
I can't imagine it. Like these are biologics prices, right?
Oh yeah.
These are biologic prices. So really quite a big surprise to me about how costly it is. But you know, it's not for me to say. I just can't imagine.
Yeah. Yeah. That
yeah, anyone actually.
It would be, if it was free, it might be a little bit too much because it's such a, you know, just because of the side effect profile. But yeah, I don't think we need to beat up on the cost. The cost has very little to do with the cost of the drug.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So let's talk a tiny bit about, let's talk a tiny bit about what the guidelines recommend,
yeah,
given what we know about ketamine, et cetera, and what we've just described. So CANMAT, which we mentioned earlier, does say that IV ketamine is a reasonable choice for patients who have failed other therapies, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And it's efficacious as a single dose, usually relapses in 10 days. And that's kind of what we said. We have best evidence to 3 to 5. So there's limited evidence for 6 to 8 repeat infusions, but they really don't know what to do after that.
Right.
And they say lower evidence for oral ketamine or intranasal. And they're really recommending it as kind of third line for treatment resistant who have failed 2 first line antidepressants and at least 1 adjunctive one. Not for kids, not for geriatrics, not for pregnants, not for, you can understand.
And what's fascinating about that is it sounds exactly like our guideline for cannabinoids.
Yeah.
You have to try 2 or 3 other things and it's sort of as a last resort. And then and don't use it in children and pregnant people.
Right. And if you look at what they're recommending, they're saying you need to do it in a place where you can provide cardiorespiratory monitoring.
Yeah.
And the facility has to be able to perform resuscitation through ACLS, and you need a nurse or doctor on site at all times for this. So
yeah,
there's lots of kind of limits to how we might apply it. And as mentioned right at the beginning, you know, there are, the enthusiasm for this exceeds right now, I would say, the evidence base and certainly the amount of benefit versus ARMS. It really is third, fourth, fifth line in my mind.
Yeah.
And the veterans place it in a similar place. They say that it really is for the veterans in the United States. They say it's not for first line therapy, but if you've had someone who's not responded to several different pharmacologic trials, you can consider ketamine or S-ketamine.
So basically the same.
Very similar. So really, I think these guys are, it's reasonable. I think I might stress a little bit more how little is known about the long-term safety, the substance use risk, the how do you continue on beyond 6 months, and those kind of issues. We really don't know a lot of that. But I do think, you know, within the limits of guidelines, you and I have written guidelines, we know it's not easy. So I think it's quite reasonable.
But I was, if I was to write a guideline and also include all the numbers, because you know, when you say it, you know, a third line or whatever, it implies, I don't know what it really implies. It implies that it works. I don't know if everyone would go, oh, you mean by 10%?
Well, none of these things let you know your chance of it not working for you, which in this case is north of 50. And that's really important, because patients who are in these situations are feeling like they failed a lot of treatments, and is it my fault? And they need to understand that it's normal for these things to not be successful. Exactly. So let me just wrap it up here, James, because I think we've gone over a lot. We've talked a lot about the adverse events. We've talked about the nuances of how does it compare to some other interventions, what happens if you stop it, how much it costs, lots of details. But in the beginning, I signaled, I mentioned that, and you talked about it too, the concern around expectation bias and unblinding. So I wanted to save this for the very end. There is one RCT that attempted to address this. Very, very interesting design. So what they did is they took 40 patients who were suffering from quite severe depression. They were also scheduled for elective surgery. So they took these patients in, they agreed to be part of this study, and under anesthesia, they gave ketamine to some of them versus placebo to the others. Mm. In this one, it's unique, because in other studies, patients can guess whether they're on ketamine or not. In this one, they actually asked patients, and they couldn't guess whether they had been the receivers of ketamine or not. Mm-hmm. There was no difference in the score changes between placebo and ketamine, and no difference in response rate between placebo and ketamine.
Yeah, that's almost frightening.
So now, if I was a believer in ketamine, I would say, the reason you didn't is because you need the disassociation effect to get the benefit.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah.
So that's what I would argue. I don't know that's true.
No.
And this should make us give real pause to the power of expectation bias in interpreting these, particularly the ketamine ones, which are those short studies.
What a cool, like, clever way to solve one of the problems.
to really, but of course there'll be, as I can come up with already one easy
reason why
caveat. Some explanation.
Yeah.
But it is, I just wanted to leave you with that. It was just published in the last few months, and it's just another issue in interpreting this evidence that I think is so, so important for us to understand. So I think that does it for ketamine. Our next one is psilocybin. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about that in detail. It'll only be one podcast, less evidence, and we can focus much more quickly on the randomized control trials, because there's only a handful.
Yeah, no. So, and great job, Mike. I know you. If people hadn't noticed yet, you did most of the work on this one.
Yeah. Well, just like you with your diet stuff.
It's all different. It's all good. But I mean, this is a lot of work. Look, and it's a lot of work to figure it out. You know, what are the endpoints? What do you got to think about? What are blah, blah, blah. Now, fortunately, you know, we've looked at a lot of stuff for depression and so on, so it helps a little bit, but it's a lot of work to tease this all out. And it's especially frustrating because the studies are, you know, 7 days and 12 people and with a little bit more obviously with esketamine and that sort of thing. So, but no, great job. Anything else you want to add to this?
No, I think that's good, James.
So I think we'll just leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.